you guys can jump in whenever you're ready.
All right. Are you ready, Sasha?
I'm ready whenever you are, Cal.
Okay, great. Thanks. Welcome to Community and Ecology, a KZYX special series that takes an in-depth look at environment and social issues confronting us in Northern California and Mendocino County. This series originates with the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit educational and research center located on the Mendocino coast. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. Today, our guest is Sasha Lilly. Sasha is a writer and a radio broadcaster. She was educated at the University of California in Berkeley, where she studied international studies and development. She's a co-host of Against the Grain, the syndicated program produced at KPFA Radio in Berkeley. She's a writer, the author of Capital and Its Discontents, Conversations with Radical Thinkers in a Time of Tumult, and the editor of Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, forthcoming in 2012 from PM Press. She's also the editor of the political economy imprint Spectre. As a program director at KPFA, Sasha spearheaded Pacifica Radio's award-winning coverage of Winter Soldier about the costs of the Iraq and Afghanistan occupations and more. Sasha, I wonder if you would not mind if I just jumped in here with a quick question. I know a lot of people know something about Winter Soldier. Would you mind just refreshing us? Tell me what Winter Soldier means and what that program was all about. I know it got a lot of attention, and I know the last time you were up here in Mendocino County speaking, you were speaking on the costs of these wars.
Sure. Well, Winter Soldier was a broadcast, it was in fact an event that was organized by Iraq Veterans Against the War, the formidable group of people who have organized themselves in the United States to try and tell the story, at least one aspect of the story, about the human costs of the U.S. occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. And it took its inspiration from an earlier Winter Soldier, which was organized during the Vietnam War, a chance for people who had been sent to fight in Vietnam to come back and tell the story of what really happened there. And so as with the Winter Soldier in the 70s, the Winter Soldier that was broadcast here and all across the country several years ago about Afghanistan and Iraq, it was a really powerful, heart-wrenching experience to have these people, these soldiers, come back and not just talk about the horrors that they had witnessed, but also talk about the war crimes that they themselves had participated in. And so in that sense, it was a tremendous moment with a great deal of attention across the country to hear an entirely different side of the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan.
And Winter Soldier, what does that mean?
It comes from a Tom Paine quote about the summer soldier and the winter soldier. And I think it was chosen, this is of course back in the 70s, as a way of speaking to the dark side of war.
I see. I just, at our conference in February, a sub-theme was the cost of war and how war undermines almost every effort at environmental and social progress. And so I think it needs to be part of this discussion. But let's turn to more recent work that you're involved in, two topics in particular, your work on the economy and the economists, and your more recent work on what you call catastrophism. We all know we have an economy in serious trouble. Whether or not it improves is important not only in our own immediate lives. Certainly there are people suffering here in Mendocino County, but it may well determine who is our next president. So let's start with this. What's the problem today as you see it? What is it that we have? A recession, a depression, the great recession? How can we frame this topic and get into a good discussion of it?
Well, I think it is a whatever one chooses to call it, and some of the arguments around terminology I think are very technical. But While we're officially out of the recession of 2008, what we are in is a severe crisis economically and socially. And it looks like we may be going back into an official recession again, while it still remains to be seen. The International Monetary Fund has said that if action is not taken by governments, the economies of the United States and Europe will slip into recession by next year. But, you know, the language of recession doesn't really speak at all to the impact of recessions or depressions on society, and I think, of course, we see that all around. I think the question of whether another recession or not, let's just say another crisis, is in the offing is a really serious one, because while, again, statistically, the United States is out of recession, if it goes into a second recession, the kind of effects of that, the social effects, are likely to be much more severe than the already very severe effects of the 2008 crisis, because clearly the results of the 2008 crisis are very much with us in terms of extremely high unemployment and underemployment, that is, people looking for full-time work who can't find it, which is probably around 16% in the United States, and in certain areas way higher. In California Central Valley, for example, it's just official recession, official unemployment without counting in underemployment, is 20%. So if the economy goes into something, another crisis, you have already so many people out of work, and people who've even given up looking for work. And at the same time, you have the really cataclysmic results of the ways that governments, including the government of the U.S., has handled the economic crisis of 2008, which by cutting social spending, cutting government spending, laying off public sector workers, which really kind of flies in the face of conventional wisdom, you know, mainstream economic thinking about how governments should handle recessions. So if the economy, global economy, the U.S. economy, goes into recession again, the starting point at which it will happen is so much more dire than even was seen 3 years ago.
So things could get worse before they get better. You've talked to, interviewed, and written about many of the very top people in this field, the field of studying the economy and studying economic crisis. What's what would you say is out there? How do people analyze this crisis? You might even begin with the right. Listening to the news, it seems the right thinks it's just a problem of too much government. But what is the spectrum of thinking from the right through Keynesianism and beyond?
Well, as you say, on the right, the idea is that governments have been too profligate. They've spent too much on, well, they've spent too much, but it's, they've spent too much usually on welfare or health care. The right doesn't tend to argue that governments have spent too much on the military, although, in fact, the military budget is a very significant, huge part of the U.S. debt. So their argument is overspending led to this unsustainable situation, and the only way to get out of it is by just devastating whatever government spending has been left on, again, health care, welfare, subsidies to the poor, and so on. However, I would say that that perspective, that right-wing perspective, is very much discredited amongst most mainstream economists, and I don't mean lefties, just within the mainstream. That's pretty pretty much flies in the face of sort of conventional wisdom. Within the liberal economics, the focus has tended to be on regulation, and that what got us to this point was that there was a financial sector of the economy that has grown and grown and grown, and has been there has been very little regulatory oversight over finance. And so what happened was you ended up having these financial institutions, investment bankers, and so on, lending money willy-nilly through a lot of very complex and Byzantine financial instruments, derivatives, and credit default swaps, and all sorts of mind-boggling devices, ways to try and basically have risky investments and then hedge their bets against risk in case the risk ever sort of came to a head. And that led to a bubble in the housing sector. It led to all of this, all of these risky loans being given out to people to remortgage their houses or buy new houses. And sooner or later, that the piper came to call and they all came crashing down. So according to those people...
Now, is that what you're calling the conventional wisdom?
Yes, I would say so. And that would also be the kind of... Some of the people who we might think of as liberal economists of note would argue that, the Joseph Stiglitzes of the world. And that, so what they argue then is that we need more regulation, that the kind, there had been regulations that had been put in place during the New Deal, such as the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated investment and commercial banking, and that those regulations were taken away in the late 90s, and that those sorts of things need to be restored. And if those were restored, we'd basically get back to where we need to be. Now, that's not the same as how they think that the recession itself needs to be dealt with on that ground. So, you know, what I've just been describing is their argument of how we got to this moment. And then what they argue now is that since we are in this situation, this very perilous economic position, what it does not need to be done is what governments have been doing, well, the world over, which is cutting social spending. And they follow that kind of classic Keynesian model, following John Maynard Keynes, who in the midst of the Great Depression reasoned that to get an economy out of recession, you needed to get money into the hands of, you know, ordinary people, get them spending. And as they spend, it will stimulate the economy. And in many ways, the New Deal followed that logic under Franklin Delano Roosevelt of putting money into public spending, public works projects. The WPA was one example of that, the Works Projects Administration, to employ the unemployed, get money into their pockets, get them spending, and then they would get out of the economy would get out of recession, which... You know, there are a lot of debates about what happened in the 30s and whether, in fact, actually what got the U.S. economy out of the Great Depression happened to be massive spending on World War II. But leaving that aside, that's what they argue.
But that's not what Obama has been arguing, is it? Or until recently?
Indeed not. In fact, Obama seems to be very much situated within kind of the right... rightward edge of the spectrum in terms of thinking about the economy. And, you know, there's been a lot of, I think, blame laid on at the feet of the Tea Party. I mean, I'm happy to lay blame at their feet, but demanding that Obama cut, you know, again, this whole notion that the real problem is the debt rather than the need to stimulate the economy. But really, there's a fair amount of evidence that Obama has been actually happy to go along with that agenda up until, you know, fairly recently, and I don't think he's really backed away from it, to have the kind of, you know, the cuts that the right has pushed for. Obama, in many ways, has seemed fairly actually happy about that, even though, again, it does really contradict conventional wisdom. He has a bill which, if you like, we can talk about, which is in some small way kind of a concession to that more established wisdom about how to get out of recessions. But even then, it's not very substantive. And then, if you'd like me to talk about the views on the left...
Well, let's just say as long as it's in the air and it seems to be the campaign... issue that he wants to talk about. What do you think about what he's putting forward as a jobs program?
Well, I mean, one can see why he's worried, because as you had said earlier, election year is next year, and most Americans are not chewing their nails about the deficit and the debt. They're concerned about jobs. If they don't have them, they're very concerned, but a lot of Americans are concerned at the prospect of not having one soon. What he's proposed is a kind of very modified stimulus, again, kind of following the logic of Keynesianism that I described, but it's so moderate that it is unlikely to make a big dent in the current malaise. It's estimated that his plan, the American Jobs Act, would create about 1.9 million jobs. Yet the recession has thrown 14 million people out of work, and then additionally there's 25 million who can't find full-time work. So in terms of what it will actually do, the kind of impact it will have, it's really questionable. And the effects of the bill are really expected to only last through the year 2012, which perhaps could be seen fairly cynically. Come 2013, they are not going to continue. And on top of that, if there is a second recession, then, you know, all of this will be, hardly something that anyone will remember. I should say that there is a part of the plan which he would cut the Bush-era tax cuts for America's richest, which, of course, is a good thing. But then there's also the question of whether any of this will, or most of this, will get through Congress, given the opposition of Republicans to that kind of thing.
Now, I know this isn't, Sasha, your specialty, or maybe it is, but just out of curiosity, why do you think such a modest plan drives the Tea Party people and the Republicans so wild? I mean, watching the debates on these economic issues, it just seems, to be honest, crazy. Noam Chomsky recently said it's just off the charts. It's just nuts. And he's usually more measured. What do you think? You're following this.
Well, I think it is. I can't get in the heads of the far right, but it appears to me to be an opportunity that they see to be able to restructure America the way they want it. I mean, for a lot of us on the left, I think we look back at the past decades and think of how much the kinds of social gains that people have organized and fought for have been eroded. But for the right, they see the opposite. They think that they kind of lost the 60s and that that there has now been this just enormous expansion of government and that you have the poor riding high in some way. What is interesting is it does seem that the kind of push for austerity isn't being driven by the main financial institutions on Wall Street. Maybe that's because they realize that if another recession hits, I mean, on the one hand, they get bailed out, so, you know, they're luckier than most. But there probably is some realization that if it's just cut, 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 and the economy tanks, that might actually not be so good for them. I mean, I think it depends on, you know, who you are and how you're placing your bets. But it is interesting that it does appear that quite a bit of the political push for this kind of thing is actually coming from the small business lobby, which is a big part of the Tea Party. And I think there's a problematic tendency on the left to often think of big business as bad, but small business is okay, whereas, in fact, a lot of the right has been fueled by the agenda of small business people who would like to have as a few taxes as possible and somehow feel like they are getting shafted.
Now, is that the sort of classic analysis of the petty bourgeoisie, as we used to say?
You might say so.
Yeah. Well, so we have Keynesianism in varying degrees, I guess, in terms of how much intervention, at what cost, and so forth. Is there something more than that on the spectrum? Is there anything, is there a left-wing critique of Keynesianism?
Yes. I mean, the left-wing critique is very much of people outside of power. So in terms of their impact, it doesn't have a sort of political corollary in the same way that the mainstream or right-wing approach might. But there is an analysis on the left that what the crisis that we've seen and that we seem to be very much still in the midst of is not simply the product of deregulation, that if the economy was regulated again, this would not just put the genie back in the bottle. And that perspective comes from, you know, a much more left-wing critique of capitalism itself, which understands capitalism as a system which is perennially one of booms and busts, and that can be quite dynamic, and yet also the dynamism, in a way, just sort of takes on a life of its own and creates these situations that are, I mean, I'm simplifying here, but, you know, the kinds of bubbles, the kinds of excesses, perhaps, as maybe Alan Greenspan would term it, that ultimately comes crashing down, and that the kind of regulatory changes, which are real, that did happen in the past number of decades, actually preceded bigger changes within the way capitalism was organized. So they weren't simply the result, but that deregulation was not the cause of it, but that actually there were other dynamics going on. And so what they would point to is basically the last serious crisis of capitalism in the 1970s, which came out of the sort of crashing down of the post-war boom, which was a remarkable time for capitalism historically, the period for, after World War II up until the late 60s. But in the late 60s, profitability after peaking started to sink, and workers around the world, certainly in the United States, in Europe, were becoming increasingly restive and had more and more social power, which demanding a bigger slice of the pie. And so those, or some, I guess, prescient people in positions of power realized that for capitalism to be profitable in the way they needed it to be, it needed to be restructured. And what came out of that is what is termed neoliberalism. I think it's a very confusing and unhelpful term because it's not about social liberalism. It's liberalism in the European sense of free markets. And it really had to do with restructuring economies in the global north and in the global south, a real sort of all-out class war on trade unions. Margaret Thatcher in the UK sort of epitomized that spirit with her war on the miners. And capitalism was restructured in a way. Now, there's debate around this aspect of things, but one perspective, which I have to confess I'm sympathetic with, sees that whole restructuring, which involved moving manufacture from unionized areas in the United States to non-unionized areas, such as in the U.S. South, or to China and the maquiladoras on the U.S.-Mexico border, going after unions and restructuring the labor process, that all of those things combined to actually spur on another, if you'll excuse the jargon, round of accumulation, which was really profitable for capitalism.
Well, sorry, Sasha, mm-hmm. Round of accumulation. When and what was this? Just to, you know, maybe people will have some memory of the period you're talking about.
Well, in the 1980s and 90s, after, in the early 80s, if people remember, under first Carter and then Reagan, you had the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, raised the interest rates up 20%, a shocking amount, to basically put people out of work, an intentional recession to discipline workers in the United States. And that was the most serious recession before this one, in recent years. And out of that, there was great restructuring. As I say, union factories closed and moved to the global south. The whole structure of industry really changed on a global level. China became the center of global manufacture. there was a huge transformation, and it's still ongoing, of people in China and in East Asia, of people coming from the countryside and becoming workers, so many of them actually women. So this massive transformation that went on, I mean, it has been called, and I think, again, this is a sort of, I'm not sure if this term is too helpful because it's confusing as a term, but globalization. But globalization involved a huge amount more. It involved the disciplining of labor. It involved these geographic shifts, of course, and it involved technical innovations in the work process, these ideas of just-in-time manufacturing processes. There was a real transformation in transport around the world, which made it so much cheaper to transport products across the world, and so you could buy products from China incredibly cheaply because of shipping costs, because of things to do with actually tax on those sorts of workers, were transformed. So it was a really massive overhaul of the way that capitalism was structured, and it very much involved privatization and what appeared to be getting the state out of the economy. That's not entirely correct, because actually the state really facilitated this, but in somewhat simplistic terms, people thought it's kind of a turn away from the state towards the market. Not exactly that, but the financialization of the economy was crucial to this process, because it really allowed that kind of global production systems and exchange and trade. So all of these different processes happening at the same time that really remade capitalism, and profits certainly were increased by this. And at the same time, protest movements and the kinds of ways people had organized themselves before really took a beating from the ways that this whole effort was carried out. And I think we're still seeing the effects today. So in a moment of real crisis, you don't have the same kind of organizations that you might have had 30 or 40 years ago to take on the system and make demands. I mean, you see now the emergence of all sorts of other kinds of organizations, but that legacy is real.
And so you say you're sympathetic to this analysis. Just a word on, I suppose, the upshot. Where do we, is there something that we can think about that will help us get to a better understanding of where we're going?
Well, let me just say, because I forgot to say the other perspective on, other Marxist perspective, in fact, on capitalism, is that there was a long stagnation that started in the 70s, and that what I was describing as the source of a lot of dynamism and profitability really was more kind of froth and the appearance of that kind of dynamism. So that's a different view, and you know, people might want to explore both of them. In terms of thinking about where that leaves us, I think we need to recognize that capitalism is very dynamic and hence quite unstable. Not that that means that we can then expect it just sort of to collapse and then we can sort of pick up the pieces and create the society we want. I think that's not the conclusion to draw. But that I think it is safe to say that the years ahead are going to be tumultuous ones, and that those of us who are committed to a different society, a more just society, should really take organization seriously. Now, that's a easy thing to say and a harder thing to do, but I do think it's really important that we find other ways to organize ourselves given the constraints we face. One thing that is very clear is that if we are able to do it because of the international nature of capitalism, the way it has organized itself, and the things like just-in-time where companies don't keep large inventories, that it's actually quite, or I shouldn't say quite easy, but easier to create bottlenecks in the system by having cross-border solidarity between workers in one country and another. That's, of course, just looking at the politics at kind of the point of production. There are other things, other ways of organizing as well. But I do think we really need to take seriously the kind of system that we're up against, because only by doing that can we actually see its weaknesses.
All right, I'm talking to Sasha Lilly. This is Cal Winslow, and this is KZYX Radio. And Sasha is the author of Capital and Its Discontents, Conversations with Radical Thinkers in a Time of Tumult. It's published by PM Press, and I think that anyone who's been interested in what Sasha's said so far would do very well to have a look at that book. Now, we're going to shift gears a bit, Sasha, and I'm going to ask you about your newest project, and that is the book you're editing called Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. And that's coming out next year, also from PM Press. I don't know, how do we begin? What exactly do you mean by catastrophism? What's that word mean, and what's going on here?
Well, yes, it's a bit of a mouthful. The idea behind the book is to explore essentially the politics of the apocalypse. It seems as if catastrophes or apocalypticism or ideas of the apocalypse are around us everywhere. I mean, I imagine listeners probably saw the billboards in May predicting the end of the world that was put out by this far right-wing radio network, actually based in Oakland, called Family Radio. And they've, after May 21st came and went with no apocalyptic meltdown, they've now moved the date back to October 21st. So you can mark your calendars and look forward to that.
But just help us out a minute. The apocalypse, what is that?
Well, so the apocalypse can take different forms. But within Judeo-Christian traditions, the apocalypse is this notion that, but usually attached to the idea of the rapture. So when conditions are ripe, there will be the second coming of Jesus, and all the good people will rise up in the rapture, be raptured, and all the bad people will perish. So it's Judgment Day, essentially. And it is kind of a essential part of a lot of evangelical Christianity. But what we're suggesting is that notions around catastrophe and the apocalypse are really ubiquitous right now. There's a fascination with end times that seems particularly pronounced. Not that it's entirely new, but, you know, there's all of these predictions about next year, 2012, particularly, I think, December 21st, 2012, as being the date of the apocalypse. I think, erroneously, people are concluding that the Mayan calendar had pointed to that. In fact, it doesn't, but there's this notion that the world will come to an end. If you look in popular culture, there, you know, the apocalypse is everywhere. It's in movies. Even Britney Spears has a song called "Till the End of the World," set on December 21st, 2012, which shows how banal the apocalypse has gotten. And it is, so it sort of permeates our time. And that's not entirely surprising when one thinks of all the catastrophes that are characterize our time. I mean, aside from the economic crises that I would argue are endemic to capitalism itself, you know, one just looks back this year at the earthquake and tsunami in Japan that unleashed this horrible nuclear meltdown, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, Katrina, the hurricane this year. We're being surrounded by these catastrophes, and we're not suggesting they're not real, but what we are arguing is that it is a problem, as some people are doing, to then think that out of a catastrophe we will be able to create the world that we want. I'm not suggesting that we can't hopefully have a different society, but what I am arguing is that I don't think that waiting for a collapse is going to do it. And in fact, I think, as evidence shows, collapses don't necessarily lead to the kind of positive outcomes that people seem to hope for.
Right, now, are you shifting away from the sort of religious perspective that you mentioned to a different kind of perspective here?
Yes,
collapse. What do you mean then by collapse? You're not talking about the Four Horsemen and so forth, right?
Right. I mean, that exists, and in many ways, I think that kind of iconography does shape secular versions of catastrophism and collapse. But one can think of a lot of different examples. One, which some might see as kind of controversial, I would say, is to do with peak oil. The notion that there is, well, of course, there's a finite amount of oil in the world. But the argument that people who are proponents of this view make is that soon, easily accessed oil will run out, and we will have a very radical scarcity. And out of that scarcity, a new society will be created. So I've heard people say, in 3 years, oil will run out. We're going to have to grow our vegetables on our lawns. Of course, that's presuming people actually have lawns. And we will be able to create the sustainable society that we hope for. I think that that is a very problematic assumption. I mean, I actually think peak oil itself is very questionable. I think that, unfortunately, there's enough oil in the world to pollute us all, you know, several times over, and we need to stop using fossil fuel for other reasons. We can't wait for it to run out or expect it to run out. But that aside, it's more just that notion, and one sees it on the left, one sees it on the right, this expectation, a hope of society collapsing for some external reason, economic, environmental, and that out of it we'll be able to create a new society. And what I'm suggesting is that's actually kind of the politics of despair, that we have lost the sense that we can actually change society ourselves, so we have this hope that things will just collapse under their own weight, and I don't think that's how it works or how it's going to play out.
How does the... So there's an example of an environmental scenario, and is there a similar thing in terms of economic collapse, the idea that, a much deeper depression is coming? Is that
Well, I don't think it's just simply... I mean, I think there is the possibility of another recession, which could perhaps be more serious. But I think really the heart of the issue is that we do need to challenge capitalism. I think we need to challenge it in its good times and in its bad times. But I don't think we can expect it to just fall apart by itself, and that with the assumption that that's going to just be auspicious for us. I mean, first off, and we can see this right now, economic crises are very polarizing times, and politically. And they can, you know, in theory, and you could point to a few examples, could polarize people to the left. But there's a huge amount of evidence that people can also move to the right during these times. One can look at the 1930s, but one just needs to look at, actually, right now, in Europe, in the United States, you see people not moving to the left or to some notion of a positive egalitarian society, but they're moving to the right. They're scapegoating immigrants. They're seeing Muslims in Europe as the cause of all the problems in the United States. Immigrants, particularly from Central America, Mexico, are being scapegoated. So, unfortunately, the way that it tends to play itself out does not tend to follow that pattern at all. And in fact, when one looks at, I mean, one can't make any blanket generalizations about the circumstances in which social movements form. But there does seem to be a lot of evidence that social movements often, and including, you know, really radical ones, happen not when people are facing the kind of pit of the abyss, but when they have rising expectations, and then those rising expectations are brought to a halt. If one looks at the last period of large-scale social organization on the left in the 60s and 70s, those movements came out, and not just in the United States, came out of societies that were affluent and where people were expecting more and more out of their societies and feeling that they weren't getting what they wanted, or that society was, you know, that the promise wasn't matched by the reality. But I do think that it's just, there is this very widespread assumption, if people are just really ground down, they'll get it. I mean, it's basically a frustration, I think, with one's, you know, fellow citizens. Why aren't people seeing what's going on? And then the assumption that follows, which I think is wrong, is if people could just really have their comforts eroded, the scales would fall from their eyes, and they would see the world for what it is. I think that's really wrong. I think it's actually kind of elitist. I think it's problematic. I think that what we've seen is that, the historical record points in the, tends to point in the other direction.
Yeah, it is interesting to recall that the in the collapse of 1929, following that collapse, it was a full 4 or 5 years until there was the beginning of a working class rebellion and the big strikes of 1934. But for 5 years, really, the poor, the working class people in the United States were essentially quiet. Also thinking about what you've just said, that we've heard up here people kind of wishing we could have gasoline at $10-$15 a gallon, because as you've said, they think that that would force us to live a better way of life.
Unfortunately, I think it would force a lot of people to support more imperial wars,
right,
that were, you know, framed around cheap resources or cheap energy.
And while we're on this subject, what about is climate change? Is that an issue that you take up in this discussion?
Yes, absolutely. And I should say the book is multi-authored. I'm one of the authors. Eddie Ewan is the person who writes about climate in this. Another author, Jim Davis, writes about the right, and then David McNally writes about the ways that governments use catastrophe, which is a whole another subject. But what we're not suggesting at all is that environmental crises are not real and serious, and that global warming is not absolutely real and absolutely serious. But what we're suggesting is that organizing people around this idea of an ultimate catastrophe is not a good way of mobilizing people. I think there is, again, that tendency for activists to assume that if we just put it really out there in people's faces and say, the end of the world is coming if you don't act, they think the response is that people will then organize themselves and rise up. But what the evidence seems to point to is that actually that paralyzes people, that that sort of trying to use fear to mobilize people doesn't seem to work. And in fact, you know, you can end up with the opposite outcome. Or you can get a small group of people who are willing to take very extreme risks, and then the majority of people not acting at all, which I think is a terrible outcome. I think kind of at the heart of the argument in the book is that fear is a very bad way to organize people, and that the left would do well to be really careful about the politics of fear for a number of reasons. People may remember before the millennium, there was all of this hype and fear around Y2K, the millennium bug, that computer systems were going to crash at the millennium. There was, I remember Helen Caldicott saying, there are going to be nuclear meltdowns, all the nuclear plants are going to melt down, and people became very fearful. And they ended up hoarding food and buying Bunsen burners and being, you know, freaked out. And then Y2K happened, the millennium happened.
Was
and
it a,
there was no there a, was no big crisis.
A sort of liberal survivalism, would you say?
Exactly. Although, of course, this actually was on the right as well as within people who might identify as progressive. And that's kind of part of the point that we're making, is that if there is any content, if there's any political content to catastrophism, it's actually right-wing, because, which isn't to say that everyone who might find this appealing is right-wing, not saying that at all, but that fear as a tool to mobilize people tends to be the domain of the right, and that if people on the left get involved in that, it often turns out not so well. And there, of course, is the problem, as the, I guess, the family radio guy found who announced the end of the world in May, that if you announce the catastrophe, and of course if you put a date on it, and then it doesn't come, like at Y2K, then people end up getting, again, become cynical and apathetic. It's a demobilizing way of doing things, and I think that's just the opposite of what we should be doing in terms of organizing against these very real things that our societies are facing economically, ecologically, and so on. But that fear itself is really, really problematic.
And I see in my notes here that there's also the issue of the government itself as a source of fear-mongering. And would you say something about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think those in power or in positions of power often deploy catastrophe to push through the things that they desire to achieve, and that might be harder to do during other times. In one example, actually, was the whole manufactured crisis around the debt ceiling, and how that if the government didn't start chopping at the debt, there would be this terrible catastrophe. And, you know, it was all, the U.S. debt is not any great danger to the U.S. economy in the immediate. So that was one example. But, you know, this is something that Naomi Klein has written in The Shock Doctrine about how she focuses, I think, on the last 30 years, actually a bit too much, but that those in positions of power, those in governments, have a history of using a catastrophe, an environmental one or any kind of catastrophe, to achieve their aims. So, you know, one example is what happened in Katrina, following Katrina, with the kind of remaking of New Orleans. But one can find all sorts of examples. I mean, it's very much happening right now in Europe, where there is a crisis which is, in its sense, real, with the Eurozone, and you have a country like, in particular, Greece, which has is taking this enormous battering from investors. It's a sort of complicated and convoluted story, but in it, there's the danger that Greece could take down the other economies within the Eurozone in Europe, and yet Greece is being told that it must, because of this crisis, it must cut and cut and cut, even though, in fact, cutting government spending, laying off public sector workers, is causing their economy to contract and make it much harder for them to actually pay interest on their debt. But they are being forced to do this within this whole under the umbrella of this catastrophe, this urgency. And in fact, although it might be quite bad for other economies, what Greece probably should do is just default on its debt. But anyway, that's another story. But people are being forced, pushed to the brink. I mean, suicides have increased in Greece. People are living on the streets. It's terrible. Same has happened in Ireland. So governments can very much use a crisis, including a crisis which is a real one on some level, to push for things which actually don't benefit people at all and don't lift the country out of the crisis. In fact, will do the opposite. I mean, that's really clearly what's happening here, is it's deepening the crisis, but it's being justified as, to use the famous phrase from Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. This has to be done. There is no alternative.
This is KZYX Radio. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program today is Community and Ecology. I'm speaking with Sasha Lilly. Sasha is a writer and radio broadcaster. She's the co-host of Against the Grain, a syndicated program produced at KPFA Radio, and she's the author of several books on the economy that we've been discussing today. Sasha, maybe we could end up, we've got with a little bit of discussion about, what you see as more positive responses to the economic crisis to the environmental crisis, with some suggestions possibly for people, both in terms of how to think about these problems and these crises, and also about, you know, what possibly we could do about them. I know myself, I've been working with a group of hospital workers in California who, interestingly, have challenged the whole idea that the country's broke by exposing the massive profits that the healthcare providers, the big hospital chains and nursing home chains, have been raking in, Kaiser Permanente, Sutter, and so forth, and the grotesque salaries that hospital administrators, in this case in California, are making. This led last week to one of the biggest healthcare strikes in U.S. history. More than 20,000 hospital workers and nurses went out on strike, basically challenging, I guess, the whole idea that what we have to do is sacrifice in the face of what we're told is this severe crisis. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think the workers who you mentioned, the union you're talking about, have it absolutely right. And it's fascinating, as an aside, to see how right now the insurance companies are using the crisis, talk about using the crisis as an opportunity to, I think they've doubled their premiums over the last 10 years. So it's been just at a time when most people can least afford to be able to pay huge amounts for health care. The costs that they have levied have just gone up and up. And incidentally, that's paralleled everywhere. You see, right in the depth of the crisis, corporations are having some of the highest profits that they've ever had since the U.S. started keeping a record of it. So I think organizing directly around that sort of issue is absolutely important. Who's profiting? Who ran up these debts in the first place, and then who's paying for them, because clearly those are two separate entities. I think it's really crucial that people point to military spending as one of the absolute key places that needs to be slashed, instead of the social programs and the positions for public sector workers, which have been just chopped away mercilessly. I think it's absolutely imperative that the cost of war gets put front and center. I mean, the cost has just been, it's unbelievable the amount of money that the United States is spending on its various occupations and on its bases around the world. So I think that's one really important part of it. I also think that it has been very heartening to see the kinds of mobilizations that are taking place after a lag, maybe parallel to what you said with the Great Depression, and people around the world in different places have been organizing themselves against austerity. I mean, it's really a defensive battle at this point, and it would be wonderful if we could get to the point of offensive battles, but I think part of the challenge is just mobilizing enough strength to do that. But one sees general strikes in India, in Spain, in Italy, all sorts of mobilizations. France, Greece has been on the forefront in many ways. But interesting places like Israel as well, where they've had tent cities, partly about the amount of government spending that goes to their military occupation of Palestine. And then, of course, the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations, which have taken place in the U.S. now, and which the police seem to be treating quite brutally in New York City. But it's certainly a hopeful sign of demonstrations and protests to come. I think, though, we do have some challenges ahead in terms of rethinking some of our tactics and ways that we organize, because although I think it's easy to be despairing about the level of political activity in the United States, one can actually point to some significant moments just in the past decade where people have come out in large numbers. I mean, if you think about the millions of people protesting the imminent Iraq invasion in 2003, and then the 2006 immigrant worker strikes, or strike that took place, the largest general strike in U.S. history, there have been these moments where people have come out to the streets en masse. But the question, I think, that radicals and leftists and progressives have to figure out and come to grips with in this country is how to organize in a sustained way that isn't just about a flare-up. How do we mobilize ourselves? And I think one aspect, and it's not the whole picture, is that we need to move away from a certain kind of tactics that emphasizes expressing one's outrage to a more tactical way of organizing where we think strategically about where weaknesses may be and target those and focus a lot on how we bring in people who may not consider themselves left activists. I think that's a big challenge for us to kind of move away from the politics of expression to a more strategic politics. But that comes through practice and trial and error, and I think that has begun. That kind of, you know, there's a huge amount of outrage in this country. I think the real question is how to have people actually feel like if they organize themselves, if they demonstrate, that it will have an impact, because I think a lot of people feel quite cynical about that. So I do think there needs to be a fair amount of attention put into how do we organize ourselves differently and how do we reach out to people beyond the choir.
Well, Sasha, this has really been great. There's a ton of information for us to think about, and hopefully it will do just that. It'll make us think more seriously about what we're doing and where we need to go. I want to thank you again. We've been talking to Sasha Lilly, the author of Capital and Its Discontents. I highly recommend the book published by PM Press. I think it's very worth your while to get out there and get a copy of that and have a read and watch for Sasha's new books, also coming out from PM Press. We're going to continue this series next week and for the next several weeks, and we have coming up discussions of ocean conservation as well as the crisis of biodiversity, lots of things to think about. So this is KZYX, this is Cal Winslow, thanking Sasha again and thanking listeners for tuning in today, and I hope that we'll be able to talk again next Wednesday at this time. Thanks and bye, Sasha.
Thank you.
All right, that's that, I guess. We made it to 57 minutes.
All right, well, I hope you felt good about it. You're a natural, my God. Cal, you've got a new career ahead of you.
Well, that's very kind of you. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're busy as, you know, crazy, but...
I hope you thought that was accessible. You know, there are moments where I hope I didn't sort of go off too much on La La Land.
No, not at all. I think lots of interesting stuff there that needs to be said. And I think the series, I don't know. Well, I've actually, in the last couple of sessions, got quite a few positive things. It's really a different kind of a series, as we talked about, you know.
I'd love to hear it. Are you holding on to...
I've just got to talk to Mary when we get off this... about how they're storing it, because I went and looked. Ignacio wanted to know if there was something on the, but it doesn't seem like they have it archived on the program, so I'm going to ask her about that. I have CDs, you know, that have just made from, you know, what we've just done. I have a collection of those, but it would be really nice. I should talk to you sometime, you know, when about what's the best way to try to preserve things. I don't even know what a podcast is myself, see, so.
Sure. I mean, we can chat about this some other time, but it's pretty easy to get a free website, and since it's just a blog site, like a WordPress blog, and if it's just, how many programs, 5 programs?
Well, it'll be probably about 8.
Okay, well, you probably would still be able to have enough space to just put them up each with a paragraph description and just have them up on the web.
Could I put them on my on our Mendocino Institute website?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was...
Yes, you should do that, because I want to hear them. I'm really curious to hear Ian's and Michael's.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they'll all be great, but, you know, I'm particularly looking forward to, I want to hear Michael's one.
Yeah, it was really good, really good. Well, I don't know. I got to go. I don't know how to turn this stuff off, so I'll just say goodbye. And
we'll be in touch. Thanks, Cal.
And I'll go.
You are going to give your engineer my email address, and she's going to send me the link with the MP3.
Okay, so give me the address.
Yeah, so just give her my email address.
Yeah, I know, but just so I have it right here in front of me.
Oh, just tell her sasha@kpfa.org. That's the easiest.
Gotcha. All right.
And then I'll take it from there. When do you need it by?
This would be played next Wednesday.
Okay, I'll get it to you before the end of this week.
All right,
that's
terrific.
Plenty of time.
All right,
yeah.
Terrific. Say hi to Ramsey.
Okay, take care, Cal. Bye.
Bye.
Demonstration down last week. Talk about old school. They brought